Hello?
Hello.
Hello.
This is Siskoid from Siskoid's blog of geekery and the Lonely Hearts Romance Comics
you're
podcast.
Good, you're good. Oh, God, you're trying to romance the audience. Trust me, it's all dudes. It's all dudes. So I don't think you
want. Now do it in French. Now do it in French.
Oh, wait, I can do it. Voulez-vous coucher avec moi ce soir? Siskoid.
No. Now I'm offended. No.
I'm not going to do it in French, but because all the titles are in English anyways, it'd be like three French words. It'd be pointless.
What about my name is Siskoid in French?
Mon nom est Siskoid en français.
Ooh, I like that.
It's the language of love.
I'm a legal machine.
Diabolu Frank.
Spoilers?
Check.
Mature language?
Check.
Should listeners be advised?
Check. Hello?
Hi.
Hi! It's good to finally get to talk to you. God, I mean, we've been doing virtual conversations and pen pal type stuff for years without actually talking to one another. We've heard each other on different podcasts, but never actually spoken directly.
It's very strange. The whole podcasting community and how we all seem to know each other, but years in and nice to talk to you, for the first time.
Well, yeah.
It's weird.
Hold on. Here comes Mac. Let's see if this is going to work. One sec. Are you there, Mac? I had him on the landline, but we've been struggling to work the internet part.
Well, I skip all these problems, usually.
How's that?
I use a radio studio.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, that'll do the job. Okay, so he's still trying to work it out and is clearly very stressed out and has no time for my shenanigans. I guess on the first episode of the Lonely Hearts podcast, you talked a little bit about the first comics you ever read, but just like a little bit. Have you ever actually talked on a podcast about your early comic reading?
I'm trying to think.
In that first Lonely Hearts, you mentioned Asterix and Tintin and probably some other foreign stuff that I don't know about.
Right. We talked about that. Yeah, we just gave our intro to who we were. Yeah. So that's probably the only place.
Can you explain Tintin to me? Because I've had like they literally like when I would have cable, we were poor, so we didn't have cable very often. But whenever we did have it, we'd always get some of those foreign cartoons on like Showtime and such. And so they'd run Tintin. I'd watch a little bit of it, and I don't get it. What is the appeal to Tintin? It's a boy. It's a dog. It's adventures and mysteries. Is there more to it than that? Is it just like exceptionally well written? What's the deal?
Well, you watch the cartoons. I mean, you lose some of the artistry.
Right.
In the sense that Hergé, the writer-artist on Tintin, Tintin's creator, is, I mean, even in things like, understanding comics or books like that, use Hergé as an example of how comics are constructed, how the narrative is constructed. So you lose that in a cartoon, obviously. The way he lays out a page, the way the action moves, like at the bottom of every page, that's something scholars have noticed, and I have too, where at the end of every page, that panel must be a cliffhanger. If the next page is facing, it's a very small cliffhanger. It's just like the dog getting hurt, but right away you see he's safe. So there's always a little something to take you up to the next page, to the top of the next page. If the next page is the reverse, then it's a bigger cliffhanger. So it's just a series of cliffhangers all the way through any given story.
Now, how old was Tintin, too?
That's hard to say. They always say he's...
No, not the character. I mean the actual strip.
Oh, we can check that out, but it's 1920s or...
Okay. The comic strips would have learned from Tintin, then.
Let me see.
Because I know a lot of the adventure strips and such, they had a similar format where you'd get your three or four panels or whatever it would be, and they would always leave it on the cliffhanger for the next day. So I'm wondering if maybe Tintin inspired that.
Yeah, well, or it was working as a strip, because originally the incept date is 1929, the first story. He was being published in Le Petit Vingtième, the small 20th, which was the comic book insert or the youth material insert in a newspaper called Le Vingtième Siècle, the 20th century. So it was one page a day kind of thing, or one page a week, or I don't know how often the newspaper came out. So it was one page per issue kind of thing. And so it needed that little cliffhanger, probably. Right. But eventually, Hergé's material was often redrawn. He redrew it, or eventually had a studio who redrew some things in his style. If you buy the albums, which is what they call the graphic novels, mm-hmm. sometimes you have some where Hergé was satisfied with his work. It looks more primitive than the book that came before, which was redrawn. Mm-hmm. In his more modern style, and when he and obviously colored, but when he did that, very often the books, the graphic novels, were larger, had a larger page than the original strips. So while he would either paste up all the panels as they were, sometimes bigger, sometimes with little art changes, sometimes completely redrawn. But when he had to, when that happened, sometimes you got the cliffhanger wasn't fitting in the bottom anymore. So in those albums, you'll see he'll just put like a piece of artwork in the middle of the page, stuff like that, where the flow of the comic was very, very important to him. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of comic book artists have learned from this. So he's important in that sense. Now, I know that, Tintin's... when I was a kid, I wouldn't say he was necessarily my favorite. I think Asterix is much funnier, so more interesting, and it gets funnier as you grow up, because there are a lot of jokes in there that you won't get in the first place. You don't get all the puns, you don't get all the political humor that's in Asterix when you're young. Tintin doesn't really do that. I mean, it's more something where the older you get, the more you you look at the form of it, and you become impressed by the artistry of it. Even though the stories they can be complex. I mean, but it's basically adventure, and he's a young reporter with a talking dog, kind of thing. But you do see how Hergé. To me, he's a lot like I'd use him in the same way English speakers would use. Someone like Will Eisner.
So it's...
Will Eisner had experimented a lot. He tried things with the form. A lot of his graphic novels and even the spirit stories are unusual and, maverick kind of work. The same thing happened with Hergé, where he, 1929, so he really developed the art form. He was there in the early days of the art form. But towards the latter days, the work becomes very experimental, where he tries things, where he takes all his major villains and he ridiculizes them. There's a lot of postmodernism in the later books. And eventually, the very last book isn't even completed. It's just sketches and scripts because he died working on it. Mm-hmm. And it's Tintin and the Alf Art. So it's about a postmodern work of art that comes into their manner there. And I don't remember the story. That's one I haven't read. I just read about it. Mm-hmm. And but it's really creepy, because it's about the nature of that piece of art, and is it art? Is modern art art, kind of thing? Mm-hmm. And then in the middle of the book, there's like half finished drawings. Like the more it goes, the more it's deconstructed. And then Hergé dies, and so he leaves the book completely deconstructed, kind of thing. But mm-hmm. Almost by accident. Anyways, so there's a lot of that playing off in the later books. The later books are more political. They're the little try things with the form. His whole cliffhanger thing at the bottom of every page in the Jewels of the Castafiore, or whatever. I'm not sure about the English titles, but mm-hmm. I think that should be it. There's always a cliffhanger at the bottom, but then it's always a cheat. There are no real cliffhangers. There's no real villain. There's no real jewel thief. It's all, you're being trolled by the comic and by the form of the comic. So it's the kind of experiments that he was doing in his later work. So he's interesting as an artist, even though the stories might be better suited for the younger reader and just seem like fun adventures in usually in Europe and North Africa.
So as a kid, the appeal was more the propulsive quality of that, every page ends on a beat and everything. It just keeps moving, keeps flowing. And then as an adult, you appreciate it more for the technical accomplishments.
For me, yes.
Okay.
So that's something you lose in the cartoon version. Although I like the Spielberg movie.
Yes,
it had that energy.
Mm-hmm. I saw the cartoons as a kid, and, you know, I brushed up against the character because he's always popping up on, you know, programs for foreign conventions and stuff like that. But I've never really pursued him because even as a kid, it didn't grab me the way that it needed to for me to really hold my attention. And then Asterisk, I look at, and he looks like Hagar the Horrible to me. So I don't know, you know, you're telling me that it's a more political and a little bit one of those like Looney Tunes where it plays to the kids and the adults, but perhaps ultimately plays better to the adults. Is that the case?
Yeah, I think so. I think if you talk to people who, if you're a French speaker, the chances are you grew up on these things. And I think there's a, you know, a lot of the same way an American might, you know, everybody's read Archie or read Richie Rich or Casper, that kind of thing. Even though later in life, they never read comics. Mm-hmm. They all had those comics and, you know, they've all been touched by those comics when they were younger.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, even me as a comic book fan, you know, I've had exposure to Richie Rich and Casper, but it's so far back and it's something that I haven't held on to. I tend to forget those characters even exist a lot of the time.
Right. Because I learned English or reading English thanks to those. Mm-hmm. But if you're a French speaker, chances are, even if you're not reading comics today, you have Tintin and Asterisk still in your library, still on your shelves, mm-hmm. Because they're handsome books that you can keep forever.
Oh, yeah. I was in Europe a year or so back, and even in the train stations, you would see, you know, the little convenience store type train station spots. You'd see, I don't remember seeing any Tintin, but I definitely saw Asterisk and several of those just traveling on the trains.
Yeah. Well, Asterisk has, I mean, whenever an Asterisk book comes out, which is rare these days, one of the two, the writer dies. Died some years ago, and
isn't there a custody battle with his son or something? Like he's fighting against a publisher or something like that.
Really?
I'm mistaken. I thought I'd read something about that a while back, but I'm you're way more expert on that than I'm
sure it's possible. But the the artist kept it going. So I think there are lesser books. Mm-hmm. You know, he's got the style, mm-hmm. But I don't know. The writing is a little. He goes for stunts, in my opinion. It's like the premises are a little bit broad, mm-hmm. compared to what Goscinny used to do before when they worked together. But in any case, whenever a book comes out, which is, I don't know, every 7 years or so, it's a big media event. It's like, you know, there's a new Star Wars. Mm-hmm. It's that level in the French-speaking world. So I know it's read all over the world and it's translated in every language. But in the French-speaking world, it's news and there are lineups at the bookstore.
Now, how did you transition? Because do you primarily read English language comics now?
Yes.
Okay. How did you make the transition? What made you make that leap to the American comics continuities and such?
Well, they were always there. I live in a part of Canada that's entirely bilingual. So they do sell American comics. I guess I started with French translations. They had these big, fat, jumbo books, they were called. Very hard to research on the internet, trying mm-hmm. to find them again. But these were like just big trades. They looked like, Showcase Presents or Essentials. Mm-hmm. Black and white, translated with, you know, terrible lettering. And they were just, they had a mix of American comics. So usually it was DC and Marvel all mixed, all jumbled together. You might have The Flash and The Fantastic Four when side by side, along with some, you know, House of Mystery type stuff. So I'm never sure where they were from. They could have been from any horror mystery series from Marvel, even Charlton or DC. And so I collected those. They sold them at the drugstore. I collected them. I mean, at that point, I was ripping out the covers were the only pages that were in color inside the book. Mm-hmm. So I would rip those out and put them on my wall kind of thing. You know, no respect for those things mm-hmm. as objects. But eventually, you know, I taught myself to read English. It was through Archie and Richie Rich, and I had some family members who would just, you know, drop off. I guess they were their bathroom readers, and they would just drop them off like bundles, you know, 2 foot high bundles every so often. So that's how I taught myself to read. But for like superhero comics, the jumbos were my entry into it, but I still wasn't buying English language comics at that point. I was like third grade or so. You're just learning to speak English in school.
Right.
And then, as you know, I lived in Texas for a number of summers, 6 summers in all, starting around age 12. And Ballinger, Texas, a nowhere place, 3,000 people, center of Texas. And the first week we were there, I mean, we didn't really have anything to do. We don't know anyone. We can hardly speak the language. Like my kid brother was basically a mute. He was 6 years old and, people would speak to him and it was like he was, completely non-communicational, like autistic in a sense, just for the language barrier. So we went to a Walmart, which would have been it just got built. It's like one of those early Walmarts that looked just like any other department store.
I remember when Walmart was a new thing, there was Kmart's and there were Target's and then all of a sudden there was this Walmart place. So, yeah.
Yeah. So we went to this Walmart and they had, bagged comics where you've got like 2 or 3 comics in the same bag. Mm-hmm. I just needed something to read. I didn't bring more than one book on the plane. And then, I'm stuck there 2 months mm-hmm. and I'm a big reader. And I certainly don't have my comics in any language. So I got one that seemed interesting. It was Uncanny X-Men 150, whichever one is the Kitty's Fairy Tale one.
Okay, sure.
Yeah. And that damn Kitty's Fairy Tale became a sort of it became a template for plays that I read that thing until it fell apart. Where we made plays for the younger kids using that script kind of thing because she was telling a story, so it was easy to do. Mm-hmm. And the other one was like a shitty Hulk reprint mm-hmm. for Marvel superheroes.
Marvel superheroes. Yeah, yeah. Those were the bane of my childhood. I hated those.
And it was a very good one. He fights the Rhino. At least he fights Rhino.
Yeah.
So I still have that one. I mean, it never spoke to me. But when I came back to Canada, now I was interested in the Marvel Universe. I was interested in getting these same kind of comics. And I'm not sure exactly how it all fell into place. Like, did my mom buy me a few? And then, but I think the first comic that I bought for myself, aside from that bag, which was probably paid for by my dad or whatever, was DC Comics Presents number 59, Superman Ambush Bug, Legion of Substitute Heroes.
Oh yeah, that was a fun one. I enjoyed that one. I fished that out of a quarter bin in the late 80s.
So it's very much it's the first one I ever bought for myself. The first one I chose for myself. That wasn't in some kind of bundle or trade paperback type deal. And so it's still one of my favorites ever. And then from then, my early collection is a lot of, let's try this one, let's try that one kind of thing. But I guess my education, it was a good time to, early 80s was a good time to get interested in comics. Superhero comics, because Marvel Universe was just was being published. Who's Who wasn't very far off. Secret Origins was very wasn't very far off. I even bought Marvel Saga, just to learn.
Saga was great for as a primer for the if you're interested in actually learning about the universe and the whole tapestry. Marvel Saga was excellent for that. My brother bought that, and I would read his, and you take that in the tub and spend like an hour just trying to get through all that text and absorb all the information that came in it.
Right. Pre-internet, that's all we had. And I feel like I learned more. Everything I knew about both the DC and the Marvel universes, I got through, comics like those, that kind of material. And today, you can go to Wikipedia and read up on any particular subject or storyline. But I don't know. I think you miss out because you don't discover things you weren't researching. Well, so if you read Saga, you learned about, everything that happened in the 60s in Marvel Comics. But where would I go to do that today? I'd be researching, just an Avengers arc, or I wouldn't get all the information that I didn't think I needed,
Exactly. Well, that's the thing is everybody has so much information right at their fingertips with the internet, and yet people are so dumb still, not only because a lot of people don't make that effort, but also you often need context. You need to know what pieces are important and what you can cast aside. And what was great about books like Marvel Saga is they put everything in a chronological order. They didn't tell you every single whole little thing that happened that month or in that portion of the continuity. They just kept it to the basics, but they gave you a sense of this is happening in this time frame, this is happening over here, and it all kind of is part of this greater tapestry. You got a sense of that universe and an understanding of what happened when and what really mattered. So context is king. You're always going to need somebody who can take that all that noise and turn it into something significant to the listener or the reader.
Right. So that was my entry point. I mean, that's my early days in comics. And then, you know, eventually it ballooned and I was buying too much.
that we all hit that point. One thing I'm curious about, though, because it's something that I find that's different for me than it is for most everybody else, is when I was growing up reading comics, everybody I knew either read comics or they read my comics at least. And so it was just like this communal thing. I guess in the teenage years, I felt a little bit of apprehension about, you know, reading comics around people. I didn't want people to think ill of me, especially, you know, everybody's super self-conscious when you get into grade school and high school. But generally speaking, I always found somebody at every given school that was into comics as well that I could talk with and trade with and such. But it seems like when I listen to podcasts and I read other people's blogs, a ton of people were reading these comics in isolation. It was like none of their friends were into it. So what was your scene? Did you have other friends that were into comics as well, or were you on your own?
No, I wasn't on my own. I mean, as far as being unpopular because of what I enjoyed, that ship had sailed long before, I imagine. I mean, I was always the nerd. So I mean, that didn't change. I wasn't hiding my interests because in any case, I'd be picked on no matter what. That wouldn't matter. But you find friends that I think high school was like junior high. You meet a few people who, and then you exchange. You know, I did some trading. I did some comics trading, and some, you know, people that they would borrow my comics, and then I'd borrow their collections. And that's how I read all the best years of Daredevil, or not everyone could read everything, or at least buy everything on their budget. So we would trade, you know, entire collections of books.
Wow.
Just to read, like a library. But just, it was always like one or two people. Mm-hmm. And then I had one particular friend who just borrowed everything from me and never lent anything back.
This black hole, huh?
It was a bit of a jerk. You know, you'd walk into your house and he was already there rifling through your comics. My mom wasn't too keen on it. Yeah. I think ninth grade was probably the point where all the geeks got together kind of thing, mm-hmm. through almost accident. Found people that, you know, that shared the similar loves of, I believe it started with Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and then it became my role playing group. So we played Dungeons and Dragons, and then there's like a lot of comics and trading, Commodore 64 games, which were so easy to steal. It was just so easy to copy. If anyone had any game, you could copy it to all your friends, kind of thing. There was no right protect. Really. So that's like a geeky kind of scene, but it was always like, you know, four or five people, never too much more than that. Okay. But so one of my missions as a card carrying geek, and the blog is part of that effort, if you will, is to convert people. You know, I've always lent my stuff out. I've always been very free of suggestions and recommendations. So right now I've got a large DVD collection. A lot of those DVDs are out there, you know, converting people to the joys of whatever I decided to recommend. Same with my comics, same with really any media that I find interesting. So if you want your friends to like that stuff, you got to turn them on to that stuff. Mm-hmm. And so right now, I mean, I'd say a large group of friends, much larger than when I was a teenager, but everyone in there reads some comics, likes, some genre movies.
Hello.
Is that Mac?
Oh my God.
Finally.
Holy Jesus.
I was just starting to think, man, did he just finally give it up or what happened to that poor guy?
I'm on my fucking phone.
Yeah, I can tell. Finally... You're a little bit muted.
Does it sound shitty? Oh my God.
It's reasonable.
I'm so pissed off.
It's reasonable.
Oh, you're reasonable. I fucking literally, I have tried every device in my house. This is how supervillains are created. This is the origin. everything has gone wrong for me in the last hour and a half. Like, my crying blood. I don't know what. Anyway. Hey, how's it going, everybody?
Yeah, I already filled Siskoid in on the basics of your demon knight. I assume that the wife showed up.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but even then, I couldn't get. Even then, shit is not working right. That's why I'm like, fuck. I'll just download
you're on your
the
phone.
App on
my phone. I realize that obviously your shit's fucked right now.
Oh, it's absolutely unacceptable.
Well, no, I mean, we can hear you. You're audible. I can levelate you. So if this is how we're going to do it, we can do it like this.
Okay. I mean, yeah, I mean, I don't want to try anything else. If I try anything else, it'll push me over the edge for real.
Okay. Well, just stay on our side, man. It's okay.
Okay.
It's all to the good. Okay. So you missed, me and Cisco had basically just been talking about his fandom, and he was talking about how he proselytizes to folks with his DVDs and trying to share his likes with other people, which is also a lot of what his blog, Siskoid's blog of geekery, is about.
I've heard of this blog. I heard that it's quite popular.
It's not popular.
That's not what the streets say, Siskoid.
Who what is this street?
It's kind of hard to explain.
Mostly
Frank.
Yeah, I say good things about your blog, and he assumes that that's entirely the truth.
Right.
But I mean, your fair circle. Like, if you put out a post, you're going to get a fair few comments. Where it's all a matter of scale. I run a Martian Manhunter blog that I no longer update regularly, so it's just messages in a bottle at this point. You know, I'm lucky to get like one or two pity comments. You know, it's like I've got pieces of original art I'm commissioning, and I put it up there, and it's just freaking crickets. So the fact that you've actually been able to just sustain any sort of community, especially as the blogging community is slowly but irrevocably, you know, decaying and entering in their period of entropy, I think that's worth congratulating.
Well, you know, the trick is pandering.
Can't go wrong with a little Doctor Who, huh?
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, or Supergirl right now, or, you know, it's you find the thing that's kind of popular, and then you make sure you post, and then hopefully they'll look at the rest and say, oh, well, you know. And because I post, you know, two articles a day, then it means, you know, people
you're
are going to know that every
Comics
morning
Alliance.
There's something for you.
Yeah. I go to Comics Alliance, and I kind of scan through their stuff, and I'll click on one or two things on a given day, and they've only put out like maybe 8 items on a given day anyway. So yeah, you can supplement that and you're set.
Yeah. I'm a force of Comics Alliance. I do the same work. Oh God.
I think you probably do better work than, especially these days. It seems like that site's petering out. You know, they just—it's nothing but slideshows now. They're turning into like a baby Newsarama at this point.
Oh yeah,
the whole internet is clickbait slideshows now.
It's definitely getting that way. It's like nobody has an attention span anymore. Or I think there was this mad rush to generate content, usually free content, and then all the people that were really into generating that content burn themselves out, and now the internet is just becoming this wasteland. And you know, Grantland getting shut down is probably a big blow for you as well.
Well, Grantland had kind of taken a bit of a hit after Bill Simmons left, and after they sort of fired Bill Simmons. But it was a nice alternative. It was a site I frequently just went to see if there's anything interesting on, and now it's just, I don't know, it kind of sucks. Now you're stuck with like the Gawker sites, which are all freaking garbage. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, they've shuttered it at this point, though, anyway. My understanding is that Grantland, they're not generating anything for it anymore.
Oh, no, no. Yeah, I mean, the archives are there, but it's completely, yeah. If you go to there, it just says, thanks for the memories or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they've rolled off all of the major, like, sports guys onto, you know, they're going to start having their pieces up on ESPN related. Like, if you have a football Grantland post, now it's just going to be linked on ESPN.
Well, my understanding, too, is a lot of those guys are following Simmons to his HBO venture, and have already kind of been, like, there's one of the big guys went over and worked for, I think, the New York Times now. They're critic at large. Yep. So they've all kind of, you know, saw the writing on the wall and started to adjust, you know, a year ago, it seems like.
Yeah, and that's all the pop culture side of it, which was kind of the more interesting stuff they did there anyway. Obviously, there's not a place for it on ESPN's site, so those people are all not really let go, but they're sort of like, oh, my contract's up, gotta go, you know what I mean? So, yeah, it sucks. Mm-hmm. But it is what it is. That's what happens.
Okay, well, I don't want to cut Siskoid off. He was kind of still, you know, telling his story. So I'm expecting that'll end up being its own little, like a Wild Angels of Marvel or something. So I kind of want to give him an opportunity. Like, what I wanted to ask is, Siskoid, you're more of a DC guy at this point, correct?
Yeah. I don't think I've been a Marvel person since since it got really awful in the late 80s. Mm-hmm.
So is that because when you were talking about getting those big black and white giants and just, you know, picking and choosing as the opportunity presented itself, it seemed to me like you didn't have any necessarily a need to have loyalties the way that we are here, where you've got to be a DC or you've got to be a Marvel. So it's just a matter of quality. It just, they drove you away.
Yeah, for me, I mean, if I was buying things that had a combined Marvel DC, label on it kind of thing, maybe that's why I don't. I think loyalty has always been to, you know, good stories, and it's story first, art second in any case. And then you get invested in universes. So I was invested in the Marvel universe early on, in from 82 or whatever it was. And DC was just, you know, buy one here, buy one there. And I was trying everything. But when, you know, like after Crisis, a lot of books started over, especially the Superman stuff, whatever. So then that was an entryway into a completely new universe that I could invest in from the start. Basically what they tried to do with the New 52, but, fucking failed. Mm-hmm. But at that time, I was the right age for it. And I'm sure that, you know, I'm sure the New 52 thrived because of people who were my age then, when, you know, the age I was back then. Mm-hmm. But at the time it was like, oh, and so I got into the DC universe from there. And, you know, stuff like, you know, like Batman wasn't really something that I would buy regularly. It was, you know, an example of a book that did not start over. And so, you know, I got into it, rather late, or, you know, not because if there was a new Batman number one or a new Detective number one at the time, I'm sure I would have, you know, picked it up and started following Batman from day one, year one, or whatever you want to call it. But it was a lot of like crime of opportunity probably as well. I mean, it's, you know, I started in Superman because I was a fan of John Byrne, because I was already reading Alpha Flight and Fantastic Four. So it's probably that I followed, you know, it's so far away now, but I probably followed writer artists to DC, and then next thing you know, I'm a DC person. But it didn't help that Marvel suffered in the late 80s, when, you know, there was after Jim Shooter, the, you know, that era, mm-hmm. Wasn't very good. The art was poor, the stories were poor, and so I remember dropping every Marvel book regardless. It was, all of them suck right now. And then it was like Uncanny X-Men was the hardest to drop because it was the first one I started with, and the only one that I had over 100 issues of, and, you know, as a collector, I found it really painful to leave. But when X-Men number one came out, the Jim Lee one, mm-hmm. that was my, okay, well, you know, I'm out for real. And then I didn't buy a Marvel comic until, you know, very late 90s. You know. Yeah. But today I'd say I'd read more Marvel than I do DC.
Yeah. See, it's funny because I see parallels with you and me, because one of my first Uncanny X-Men issues was the Paul Smith issue. There was a Kitty Pryde spotlight, the Professor X is a Jerk issue, where okay. she fought the alien. And then I also had, I think it was X-Men Annual 8, which was the sequel to the fairy tale story you talked about, where it was her space adventure that Steve Lee Aloha right. drew. And that was a favorite of mine as a kid. And I stayed up through to the Jim Lee era, and I really hated that first arc with Claremont and Jim Lee. But because I knew that Claremont was leaving, and at first I was really bit out of joint about Claremont leaving, those three issues kind of convinced me maybe it wasn't such a bad thing, and ended up staying up until like the late teens, early 20s of the eponymous X-Men series, and right around 300 or so of Uncanny X-Men. And that's when I finally just, I think it was Fatal Attractions was coming up, and I finally decided, I've not enjoyed these books for several years now. I don't foresee a time in which I'm going to enjoy these books again. By that point, I'd already started transitioning to DC, mostly through Titans Hunt, because I dabbled in DC around the same time as you, because I was checking out John Byrne Superman. I was checking out Justice League International. But a number of those series had sort of wound down while I was reading them, and I ended up going back to Marvel. Plus, I definitely bought into the wave of Image artists. I was really into Jim Lee and Rob Liefeld and Wills Portasio, and so I was into it for the visuals for a while there, and it really wasn't until Image before I started to realize that I needed the story to go with it as well. And it seems to me like you had a lot of Marvel expatriates over at DC, and they had started building a more Marvel-style universe, but really more of a Bronze Age Marvel, which is what I'd grown up on anyway. And so when I finally did go back to DC, it felt like I was going home to the Marvel of the 80s.
Yeah. It felt like I was exactly the right age for how comics were evolving, so that when I moved here to Moncton to study, this was, you know, like when I hit university was when I first had access to a comic book shop. You know, it was all newsstands before then. I lived in a, you know, in small towns, and we just didn't have any comic book stores. So when I get here, there are comic book stores. There's one going out of business. It's selling its comics half of the cover price, basically, what's in the back issues. And then I get almost full runs of, whatever it was up to that point of Animal Man and, Grant Morrison's Doom Patrol and a lot of those, the British Invasion kind of stuff. We got, you know, big runs of Hellblazer, big runs of Sandman, and we would share them. So I get here, and then there's like this whole load of comics I was missing because I didn't have access to them. And that just, you know, you're in college, and it's all these new ideas and interesting ideas.
You're saying the new ideas.
The stuff that would become Vertigo later. So I was exactly the right age for when Vertigo or the Vertigo-ish books launched. So that all pushed me on DC's side, because every experiment that Marvel tried in that sphere, whether it's Epic or whether it's the failed Frontier line or, you know, Razor's Edge, remember that? All of that stuff didn't really work. And they never made it work in any, you know, permanent sense. So as I became a mature reader, all those mature books were coming out from DC. So that just, you know, that just grounded me in that universe. And I bought a lot of indies and a lot of the smaller companies stuff in that time. But, you know, Marvel was, you know, just out at that point.
It really did become a kind of a kid-centric company in the 90s, too. I mean, they were trying really hard to be edgy and dark, but really it was just such a juvenile mindset at Marvel, and such a money-oriented mindset that it's sort of like what you're talking about with Asterix. They got so broad that if you wanted something with a little flavor to it, they didn't have anything to offer you for the most part. And with Frontier, all the guys that you'd want to staff on those Frontier books had already gone over to DC, so you really did have a sense of the leftovers. I think Mark Buckingham and was one of the only guys that did work for Frontier, and Liam Sharp, I guess, but Sharp ended up going more to the Verotic spectrum, which really doesn't resonate, I think, with a Vertigo fan, for instance.
No. But yeah, they were marketing to angsty teens, you know, that idea of what is mature and dark. And today we mock those comics. We look at those covers and they're terrible, and we'll, you know, look at those storylines, and a lot of time we mock them. So objectively, I know it's all subjective, but objectively, those were bad comics. They did not, you know, survive. They did not, they failed the test of time.
Have you had a chance to check out the 90s Comics Retrial podcast yet?
No, but it's on my list.
Yeah, it is fun. I recommend it. What's nice, too, so far they've been about a half hour. The last one, they brought in a co-host, and that bumped it up to an hour, and I'm not really a fan of having the co-host. I really like the idea of just one guy, one comic, one half hour. But those first few episodes I liked quite a bit. But once you do an hour on Lobo Zero, you're kind of trying my patience.
Yeah.
Who likes comic books? Who likes superheroes? Who likes superhero comic books from the 90s? That's, yeah. That's about what I expected. Hey there. I'm Nathaniel Wayne from the Council of Geeks, and while I have always loved superheroes, the only period in which I was actually buying superhero comic books was during the much maligned 1990s. Now, those comic books were sitting in my mother's attic for about 15 years, appreciating in value, not even a little bit. I've now recovered them, and I'm going to be going through these things issue by issue, story by story, and try and answer, in my own little way, the big question of, were 90s comics really that bad? chances are that the answer is going to be yes. But I think that these comics deserve another shot, and they're going to get it on my new podcast, 90s Comics Retrial, part of the Council of Geeks podcast. You'll find it on iTunes under Council of Geeks, and you can also go to 90scomicsretrial.wordpress.com. So check it out and take this little trip down memory lane with me, a memory lane paved with what may be some of the worst comic books ever written. We'll find out.
Okay, so now that we've got Mac in here, I want to what I'd like you guys to do actually is I'll explain. The Secret Wars podcast has been in the works since like October of last year, and I had a bank of some recordings, but it after a while it started to feel like the damn thing was cursed, because you know I missed Rob Kelly that one time because I'd forgotten how time works and basically took a nice long nap when I was supposed to be talking to him, and then me and Mac and Fix It recorded like two and a half hours worth of our section as a group of the Secret Wars, and that's the only episode we ever completely lost to a computer crash or a laptop crash. And it just, and then whenever I try to edit the thing, it's always just like this total nightmare to try to just put it together, because it's just this complex beast. Like when Shag came in a few weeks back, after he left, and we like, I don't know if he's ever going to use the material recorded there, because it was just an absolute mess of just not being able to get traction and not really being able to get our ideas all in the same place, and trying to force the creation of an episode in like 30 minutes, 45 minutes he had available before he had to go catch a plane. And so after he left, me and Mac and Fix It, we started talking about what I thought was going to be a Rolled Spine episode, and we went so far into politics, Mac's defending the use of the Confederate flag, I'm being as indelicate as possible demanding gun control. It's like, I think Mac said something along the lines of, this is something that'll be great that you can listen to when you're an old man, but it cannot go on the internet. So finally,
I didn't defend the use of the Confederate. Whoa, back up, son. Back up. I said it's retroactive. That's the problem. When you look at the Confederate flag in the context of the 1970s or 80s, and you try and retroactively put outrage on people in the 70s and 80s, where people looked at things differently in the 70s. That was my point.
Well, yeah, but then there's been a big case made lately where 16 Candles, while a great coming-of-age movie, something that definitely speaks to white people who grew up in the 80s, Long Duk Dong was always super freaking racist.
Yeah.
So, I mean, just that you didn't know any Asian people who would tell you, hey, that's really fucked up, I can't believe you're laughing at that. So we thought it was okay, and it didn't until, like, there's, you know, like, we have Asian people in Texas now. I work with an Asian fella, and he occasionally will make off-color jokes, and I'm like, hey, I'm too white to even laugh at those jokes. I'm just much more sensitive to that stuff now than I ever could have been in the 80s, but it was still super racist in the 80s, too. It didn't mean anything to me then. I only see it now that I'm more conscientious about that sort of thing.
Right. So that's what I'm saying. It's the retroactive judging of you in the 80s when you just didn't know any better. That's what I take issue with. But now we're a more sensitive society. We understand, wow, that's super racist, and it's very, very, it's hurtful to other people. We should probably consider that. Now that kind of stuff should be, you know, looked down upon. But you have to understand the context of the 80s. People, we were, I mean, lack of a better word, we were ignorant, right?
Mm-hmm.
People were ignorant. So let them be ignorant. They're 80s. It's the 80s.
Yeah. Well, I think you have a better argument than on my side, because looking at 16 Candles, it's really hard to defend that movie as being washed as something that you can enjoy without, you know, noticing those aspects. But say the Dukes of Hazzard, it's a car with a flag on it. It's not really a major part of the show. It's just a visual. It has no political subtext really within the context of the show.
Hello? Okay. Yes. Yeah. I agree. Yeah.
So okay. So anyhow, so kind of going off the trail though.
We're gonna fight, man.
That's not a problem. I can be arbiter, because that's not a problem we have here. I still have a loyalty to Alpha Flight in the sense that, you know, they're the only option when you're thinking about Canadian heroes still in publication. I mean, from the big two in any case. But I've got to say, I mean, none of those characters are any favorites of mine. There's, you know, a lot of them are stereotypical of whatever region they come from, or many of them are lame. A lot of them are assholes. I mean, there's Alpha Flight isn't, and then there's nobody from my area ever. The only time Alpha Flight ever visited my province was when, well, not actually, they never did. There's a Wolverine story in a Free Comic Book Day that takes place in New Brunswick, and it's
shout out New Brunswick.
Yeah, well, it's drawn like fucking British Columbia. So I mean, there's no way that's New Brunswick. I mean, there's no way it's here. So it's fucking lame.
I have a question. Other parts of Canada stereotype French Canadian areas? Right. Like, you know how if you ever see like any sort of Hollywood production that has Houston, everybody's riding horses and wearing big old cowboy hats, right? Which is totally not what Houston's like. So do they do that up there or not?
Oh, fuck yeah. Of course, I live in the Maritime region, right? If you think of Maine, what your idea of Maine and that's pretty much what it looks like here, okay? But I'm also, ethnically, I'm an Acadian, which is a French-speaking Canadian with a particular history. We're not Quebecers, and, you know, the people that live in Quebec went there at a certain point in history. My people were there first or way before in what is now Nova Scotia, and then were deported, massively deported by the British, and then some stayed or ran into the woods, and I am a progeny of the woodland cowards, if you will. So the Quebecers still – they're still like Quebecers have a big, big you still there?
I'm here. Oh, I'm riveted. You're a woodsman.
What are you doing? You're doing something. What are you doing?
There's a noise.
We know you're doing something.
I'm doing nothing.
We're on to you, motherfucker.
I'm moving my location.
Okay.
Maybe that's it.
I thought you were like wrestling a badger or something. For God's fucking sake.
Let me finish moving my. Let me finish moving.
Let's do that. Let's make that happen.
Finish moving. I'm not used to being mobile, so yeah. I'm moving somewhere else. Okay, cool, man. Hey, I'm done now. Oh, awesome.
Yeah, that sounds much better. I think. Anyway, so Quebec has a huge entertainment industry, French language entertainment industry. Their own TV shows, their own movies, their own music. It's a big thing. But we don't, because we're a minority group down here. So we have something, but it's not as big, and it's not as exportable, and it's not as well known. But in any case, Quebec tries to make TV shows that take place here. Well, sure, why not? But every time they do, and there's one right now, there's one running right now, and it's painful because I've got a lot of friends who are actors. And they're in there, but they're always playing bit parts, and you got these fucking Quebecers, Quebec actors playing Acadians and putting on accents. Ugh. And no matter what, these series are always about fishermen. Like, that's all we've got. Everybody here is a fucking lobster fisherman or wants to be a lobster fisherman. Do you know how many lobster fishermen I know personally? That's right. None. So, I mean, it's always that. It's like Quebec sees us as the cliche. So they're like Montreal. They're basically the mindset in Montreal and Quebec City is that, you know, they're the big city. They're New York, and everybody else is, I don't know, Kentucky or something. So that kind of relationship, as far as the urbanites and then the hicks that live in the backwoods and are represented as cannibal rednecks or whatever. That's who we are in relation to that.
So I just love that he went from there to bumfuck Texas and back. You know, it's like, dude, you're just, the universe is against you, man.
Well, yeah, yeah, that's true. I have always lived on the what I call the rectum of the world, right on the edge, teetering on the edge of an anus.
You're the polyp of the world, yeah.
But we do. I mean, Canada is so large. It's not. It doesn't have a big population, because there's nobody. There's not enough, you know, people per foot, per square foot.
Right.
But it's the country is wider than the Atlantic Ocean is. So right now, where I am closer to France than I am to British Columbia.
Right.
Which is in my own country. You know, and I've never gone as far as, I mean, the furthest I've gone is Manitoba, which your meridian, to your meridian, I suppose.
I would assume that British Columbia is where most of your media is produced, right? Or is that wrong? Or
no, that's where most of your media is produced.
Well, anytime I hear of a movie being produced, it seems like it's coming out of British Columbia.
Yeah, Vancouver is a big filming city, and especially for science fiction, that kind of thing. A lot of science fiction productions from... It started with the X-Files, really, and you know it's only grown since then. But Toronto is also a big filming city, and Montreal is getting into it more and more, even with English media, English language movies and whatnot. So yeah, but I guess for French, in the French language, Montreal is the epicenter, and then for the English language, it's Toronto and Vancouver pretty much, and the rest of us are maybe cliches. So if you're from Alberta, you're probably a cowboy. If you're from here, you're probably a fisherman, or at least you're represented as such. In Canadian media, it's not so bad. Quebec media is awful for this. They misrepresent the rest of Canada all the time. But I think English language media is much better because the way our national television, the CBC, is decentralized. Basically, they pretty much give contracts to different provinces to create content. There's a private eye show that's set in Newfoundland, Republic of Doyle, which is pretty good. It's a fun, I'd say it has a tone similar to Castle or something like that, you know, crime drama with comedy in it. And that's in Newfoundland, where if Quebec was making it would be a fisherman cliche. Since locals are making it, it's a private eye show. It just happens to be set in St. John's, Newfoundland. So you got a lot of
fascinating.
That.
I don't know, Frank, does anything like that happen here?
What do you mean?
I don't think they do it where media is specifically produced for certain areas of the country. Like other than the closest I can think of is a dumbass like CSI Florida, CSI Miami.
Oh,
CSI
where the location is the star? Is that what you're saying?
Essentially, right?
You're getting there more and more. I mean, Justified is really it's not filmed in Kentucky. It's filmed in Virginia or something. But it's that area, and it's filmed in that general area. The Wire was in Baltimore for reals, right. and those same people made Treme in New Orleans. So there's more and more of that kind of thing. But usually, it's just so much easier to do stuff in LA or.
Well, I think it's sort of like the way things are in comics or were in comics with the media is there was that centralization. Everything happened in either New York or L.A. and everything else was a flyover. And now that you've got all these different states offering all these incentives, the film there's a greater tendency to actually, you know, take advantage of those locations and make that part of the story. You know, I mean, Walking Dead may be taking place in Virginia right now, but everybody knows it's filmed in Georgia. And, you know, it's a big part of the feel of that show that it takes place in Georgia. So I think that's national. I think we're both countries are probably seeing that, where it used to be everything was done in one or two places, and now you're getting a greater sense of, no, the rest of the country is available to you as well. Please come and take advantage of our incentives and our local color. So.
Yeah, and even now, you're getting more and more Vancouver shows, Vancouver TV shows that are playing Vancouver as Vancouver. The North American version of Primeval, which is about dinosaur hunters, takes place in actual Vancouver instead of being some West Coast city in the U.S. Or Continuum, which is like a time travel show. Continuum takes place in Vancouver and in super future Vancouver. So they're actually using Vancouver as Vancouver now. It's interesting. I mean, it's probably get even more incentives if you do that way.
Well, it's great for us too, because honestly, and you've been to Texas, so you probably already know this. We have no idea of what anything is in Canada. Literally, all I know is Quebec is French, and then there's everybody else. I can't honestly. I'm completely cocked my ignorance. The difference between Vancouver and Toronto and Montreal, well, Vancouver and I don't know. Honestly, I can't tell you any of the landmarks. I've never been to Canada. I know nothing. And I'd love to have a media education, but a lot of what you're saying to me, honestly, it's like a foreign language, because I don't understand. I don't know. I have no spatial relation. I don't know where one city is versus another city. I don't know how the provinces work. I am completely a ignoramus about this stuff. So I'm definitely fascinated by it, but I got to cop to it. I don't know half of what these specifics are. It's an education for me, though.
And I don't know a lot about my own country, you know, not having been in some of those places. I do the same. I imagine Saskatchewan is just a wheat field. It's a giant wheat field. And people tell me that's what it is, but I'm sure it's not just that.
Well, I think it helps. I think it helps if you line up the province and territory with its corresponding America, right? Like if you picture British Columbia attaches to, you know, Oregon, Washington, it's that same, you know, it's a coastal city, so you have some beaches, but it's very much that rainy, wooded, you know what I mean? But it's West Coast rainy, wooded,
sure,
you know what I mean?
So far,
so yeah. Right, and then you go the other side to Nova Scotia, and it's like you're in Maine, right? It's that whole
little white the lighthouses coast, and
Rocky Coast, lighthouses, things like that. And then you have Alberta. Alberta's sort of, they call it the Texas of Canada, right? I mean, I've been to Calgary, so I can kind of see the parallel. Everything up there, you know, everything down here is Texas Angus beef, and up there it's all Alberta beef. Right. So I get the parallel there. So,
Calgary Stampede. And so it's easy to bring out the cliches of each place, obviously, you know. It's like everybody that when people learn that I used to live in Texas, they go, oh, did everybody carry a gun? Was it all cowboys?
Our legislation would make you think so.
Yeah, well, today. But even back then, I mean, it's like it's when you actually see Texas in a film, in Texas playing Texas, like in this year I watched Boyhood.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Yeah, the movie about, you know, that was filmed over the...
Sure, oh, yeah, yeah.
How many years, right?
Pretend that they're not part of Texas, I think. But, yeah.
But it takes place, you know, it takes place in Central Texas. Mm-hmm. And just looking at it, and it was filmed in Central Texas, and looking at it, it's like I was right back in Ballinger. I was right back in, what was it, Bumfuck, Texas. Mm-hmm. The same, you know, it looks like something. The light is a certain way. So it brought me back to that. But every other Texas that you see on TV is very often not Texas at all.
A couple of movies I'd recommend if you're feeling nostalgic, Brewster McCloud and Urban Cowboy. They both are great snapshots of late 70s, early 80s Houston and surrounding areas. And when I see those movies, I just get like rapid flashbacks of times when I was in those areas. And like you said, the lighting and the way the ground is, it's like tactile memory. It gets fired up by those two movies when I see them.
Oh, and also RoboCop 2.
Don't make me watch RoboCop 2.
I think RoboCop 2 was still in Houston, right?
Yeah, and I knew a kid who was extra in that. It was either 2 or 3.
The Frank Miller one, right?
Yeah. Well, 2 and 3 were both based on the same Frank Miller script. They broke it into two movies and then swole it up with extras.
2 wasn't that bad, was it?
I never
3
saw
was
it.
Terrible. I don't think 2 was that bad.
I it was bad enough.
And I'm sure you'll agree, things are strange in fiction, and you ought to see the magnetic hill and the river sink fall are some of the things that'll thrill one and all.
Ken is dope.
I know fucking nothing. We got to like do from what he's saying, you can't do a road trip. I was about to say, because...
Oh, no way. Dude. Oh, my God. First of all, everything's in kilometers. I remember when I left the airport in Calgary, the woman I was with made me drive. We get in the car, and the first thing I see is speed limit 90. And I was like, what the hell? 90 kilometers an hour. I'm like, oh, we're barely moving. This sucks.
I'm going to need a calculator to travel in this country.
No, all the speedometers are kilometers. Bro. Now, if we road tripped, I'd have to probably, that's true. Oh my God, I'm freaking ill.
Jesus.
Sorry.
Two things before I forget. One, do you know any indigenous people?
Sure.
Okay, because like from I know if I walk out on the street, I'm not going to run into any indigenous people in Houston. But
I think
from like Alpha Flight and other and Justly United and stuff that you guys were just, you know, filthy with indigenous peoples.
There are, and we call them First Nations. Mm-hmm. That's the current euphemism, or that's what we call them. But if I go out right now, I'm not sure I can, I can.
Swing a dead cat. I don't think I can. The First Nationer, huh?
Yeah. When I was growing up, I lived right on the border of a reservation. So we had Maliseet Indians coming to our school. And for a while, one of my best friends came from that reservation. And I mean, so I have indigenous friends, if you will, but it's not like there's a lot of them live on reservations and remain on reservations and don't come out of there, and they become kind of ghettos. So it is a problem.
Do you guys have a comparable history with your native people that we have with ours?
Well, there are issues.
One half, so three quarters, you know, how bad. Because, I mean, if you're bringing up reservations, I know that there's probably some problems there. So were you as like a quarter as awful as us, 50% as awful as us?
I think it depends on the region. Mm-hmm. They have their own governmental council on a national level, so they have representation that's beyond anything the U.S. has.
Right,
you're right. So, and in the reservations, they're allowed to practice their cultures as they wish it. Let's bring it back to the fishermen. The fishermen in the north of New Brunswick were once at odds with native fishermen who were allowed to fish regardless of season or whatever. And because it's big business and the fish stocks are going down and whatever, there has been fighting among them, like burning boats. And there was a lot of that in, you know, in the 90s. But I think they've negotiated, and you know, it's also about education, showing the natives that they're contributing to depleting stocks of a resource that they will also lose if it keeps getting depleted. And at the same time, you know, so, and a lot of that is also a French-English question, where most natives are English-speaking, but those fishermen in the north of the province are French-speaking. And though, you know, the French and English have always been at odds, I suppose. So there's a lot of hate towards Quebec as a separatist state.
Plastique word.
Yeah, plastique. And so the more separatist feelings in Quebec, it's not everyone. If it were, they'd already be separate and sovereign. But they've got their own English-speaking peoples, and including a number of tribes living on the territory who speak English or their own native languages. So inside the province, there's no real consensus. But the pure Quebecer, if you will, that's how they call themselves, the pure Quebecer probably wants a sovereign Quebec and probably hates English Canada for denying them that sovereignty. So you've got that going on, and then the rest of Canada hates Quebec for being that person in the family who wants to leave the family. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's a very weird relationship, because if you hate a separatist Quebec, if you hate Quebec, you hate it for wanting to leave. So we love you so much, we want you to stay. We need you to stay inside our Commonwealth. Anyway, it's very strange. And for a French speaker like me, there's really a bitterness towards a separatist Quebec, because it disrespects the, you know, French language speakers outside Quebec. And if it leaves, then our rights are in danger, because is there really a need for a bilingual Canada without a Quebec in it?
Interesting.
It could fray our language rights in that sense. But at the same time, Quebec disrespects us all the goddamn time, as if we don't matter and we don't count. And they openly mock us as people who speak a doggerel, more doggerel kind of French, which isn't true.
Wow. Crazy to me.
Well, you know how...
Being a Texan, I mean, there is a Republic of Texan movement and secession and things like that. Right. None of it's ever getting off the ground.
I don't think that's anywhere near as sensitive. I mean, didn't they have like terroristic acts as early as recently as the 70s?
I was in fact conceived during the October crisis, where mailboxes were exploding. I like to think of that key orgasm taking place as a mailbox explodes outside. My parents were in Quebec City, where it was all happening. But it's like a month of terrorist activity kind of thing. One person dead kind of thing. Like Plastique is Plastique still wanting that and still being a terrorist by the 80s was a total anachronism. A lot of people talk about sovereignty. They don't talk about separation. They talk about sovereignty, where they stay inside the union but have a greater number of rights. It's like they'd be split from the federal government, but still use our money, or, you know, that kind of thing. Just increased rights or increased liberty to make decisions about things. Unfortunately, the whole separatist argument or sovereignist argument has turned into this racist thing where what they really want is the control over is immigration, which is a federal thing, because of all these ethnic people from elsewhere who come to their part of the country and then speak English or don't speak French. So there's a lot of hate. The last election was almost, we just had an election in October, and somehow the hate mongering turned on the wearing of veils by Muslims, as if this was suddenly an issue. And so they've got a fair few of communities in Quebec who put up signs about, you know, if you're not a real Quebecer, leave, and stuff like that. It's very strange.
Wow.
They did John Oliver did one of his Last Week Tonights, which I don't know if you get that up there.
Yeah, I think I saw the one with where he wasn't allowed to tell us how to vote.
Yeah, and he got Mike Myers dressed as a Mountie to tell you how to vote. Yeah.
Yeah, I saw that one. And well, he had us dead to rights. And Harper's out. He got his way. John Oliver got his way. But it's far less about here. I'd say, you know, how the way we look at America through the news, the way we look at the U.S., there's a deep divide between the left and the right, and the north and the south, more or less. Or, you know, that's what it seems to boil down to. Here, it's really very much more about language. It's French versus English, and that's the really sore point. That's the stuff you don't talk about. That's the stuff that turns into vitriol on almost every comment section of any news site in Canada. It's always these bigoted Anglos attacking French language speakers, or the opposite.
But, you know, that's the thing. I think that's true of every country. I think everybody has to find something to be really pissed off about.
Yeah.
You know, so. Well, I'll bring up to the Rangers as far as our Texas superhero team.
Oh, yeah, the Rangers.
The Twister, Texas Twister, Shooting Star, Red Wolf. And wasn't there another one?
Two Gun Kid. I'm just trying to think of any of the random.
So the point being is Alpha Flight just completely makes the Texas super team look terrible. And also, how about that cultural appropriation of Alpha Flight for Captain Marvel?
For Captain Marvel?
Yeah. Okay. Never mind. That'll come up when you get that far into the Secret Wars, post Secret Wars gameplay. So I don't want to ruin anything for you.
Did they turn somebody Canadian? Or
do you want me to tell you what it is?
Oh, yeah. Tell me. Okay. Yeah.
Well, basically, they've upped Captain Marvel's game to where she's like a global player, and she has a whole big support network, and that support network is Alpha Flight. But they're not the Canadian super team. It's like that's just they've reappropriated that name for her support network, essentially. Like she's got like aircraft. And I think that they're based out of, I thought they were based out of the Baxter Building, but maybe it's another base. I don't know. But the point is that's where Alpha Flight's going now. Is it's a supporting element to Captain Marvel.
Well, that makes sense. The name makes sense with her being a pilot. And I don't have any feelings about it one way or the other. I mean, Alpha Flight has always been, it's a very strange superhero name, a superhero team name in the first place.
Does it make any sense at all? It doesn't make any sense at all, does it?
Not really. It's just a name, you know, it's just a name. I mean, and most of the characters, it's like I said, I have no real attachment. I want the team to exist. I've got a Canadian patriotic interest in the team, and I thought the last miniseries they did,
that's the one that was it Dale Eggleston who was doing it,
right, was doing the art,
and Greg Pack and somebody else was
the
other
his friend, not Pack was not it,
not Brubaker, who's doing it with Pack,
Jesus, why am I blanking on this?
Well, I mean, the whole point was to make was to be goofy, but you didn't have the background for it, and I completely blew that joke, so I don't want you to feel like we had to take that too seriously.
But that miniseries was actually good.
Yeah, I actually heard good things about that one. People seemed to like that one.
Yeah, I liked the characterization. I liked how the country was represented. Mm-hmm. I liked that it had a political subtext that made sense in the Harper era. The locations looked real. Eaglesham's wife is apparently a French-Canadian, so the French was correct, which is very rare. John Byrne certainly didn't manage it with North Star and Aurora. They spoke some kind of, you know, pidgin French. And then and the places looked, you know, there was good photo referencing. So it looked like Canada. The characters were actually cool. And even somebody like Marina, who is dead in the water, if you'll pardon the pun, normally was actually the funnest character there. They gave her a personality implant that made her the coolest. So, of course, they had to somehow resurrect everyone because everyone was dead. But
just means they're Marvel characters.
Yeah, pretty much. The other Texas Rangers are Firebird and Phantom Rider.
Phantom Rider.
Yep.
Ghost Rider. When they rebranded Ghost Rider, Phantom Rider.
Oh, okay.
Was it a successor, or was that the one that actually got all rapey with Mockingbird?
I think it's the rapey one who is possessing his descendant.
Yeah. That's fucked up.
Yep.
Yeah.
Hey, here's my last Canada question.
Okay.
Did you watch Kids in the Hall?
Sure.
Oh, okay.
Well, our understanding is that Canada disowns their own children, Kids in the Hall.
Really?
Yeah. That's the way they tell it, actually.
That may be, but I mean, when they had a show on TV in the 90s, in the early 90s, for sure I watched it.
Well, we have love for those. We've seen them live, and we love those guys. So
yes, they're the best.
Okay,
and most of those sketches still hold up, and I will watch them on YouTube. I will go down a Kids in the Hall YouTube rabbit hole where I just jump from suggested video to suggested video and just blow a couple hours watching old Kids in the Hall skits because I love it so much.
And they were so fucking good live. It was hilarious watching them live.
They're awesome. Awesome, awesome.
Plus, Dave Foley's like my spirit celebrity. If that's like the closest thing I approximation to my looks is Dave Foley. Since I never want to reveal myself.
Absolutely. Very, very bizarre similarities.
Now I'm older, so now I look like pudgy, drunken Dave Foley, but you know, still there.
I liked it. I mean, the Kids in the Hall were a thing. I mean, I didn't know they were disowned today. I thought that was reserved to the bare naked ladies. But
no, it's actually the way they told it is during the HBO years when they were actually, you know, first run television that nobody in Canada gave a rat's ass about them. And that they basically the way they told it is that Canadians in general don't really take ownership of their people when they go abroad.
Yeah, that's possible. I mean, we didn't get HBO. So I don't know if we saw the same material, probably did, but possibly repackaged, or I just don't. We can get HBO now, but back in the day, that was not in the cards. So I don't know what that program was necessarily. But I mean, I wasn't exactly a mainstream media watcher, so it's possible that we loved the Bare Naked Ladies, but not the Bare. I mean, the Kids in the Hall. I'm sorry. It's possible we loved the Kids in the Hall, but you know, the mainstream didn't. That's very possible.
Well, honestly, I don't think the mainstream in the States really embraced them either. And I think they were always sort of a cult hit in both countries.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, it's for the mainstream viewer, they were way too gay, for one thing. There's a lot of gay humor.
Yeah.
So that probably didn't fly with parts of the country. So they were very offbeat. But, you know, Canada produces a lot of sketch comedy type material.
SCTV. So
SCTV started here. Yeah.
Spawns from it, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And Kids in the Hall would be the second biggest, probably. And the rest isn't as exportable. Quebec is probably the capital of comedy. They've got a big stand-up comedy festival, international and all that. They produce a lot of comedians, of course, French language. But yeah, they produce a lot of comedy, a lot of comedians. And those comedians go on to have big movie careers in French language media. So it's similar to Saturday Night Live performers. But most of our sketch comedy today in English, in any case, is pretty much political. It's like a fake news show, or it's, you know, Daily Show type stuff.
Sure.
So it's a lot of spoofing politicians. And here the politicians are pretty approachable. Even a robot like Stephen Harper let himself be approached by comedians that worked on these shows. And we have footage of the most robotic prime minister in Canada's history, French, making out with a sketch comedian dressed as something or other. You know, stuff like that. You'd have sketches where the party leaders are in bed together with a comedian in an actual bed in a hotel somewhere, you know, playing along. You don't get as much of that in the States. You do get some of it, but here it's very, I don't know, it's very loosey-goosey. So it's probably easier for sketch comedy shows to incorporate political humor and characters. I don't know. It's a bit strange, I admit.
Well, I mean, I kind of respect it. Hey, you know what? At least, like you said, the approachableness of it is kind of, I can respect that.
Whereas, but we can't export it. So it's not like Kids in the Hall, which, yeah, you can't export that. Nobody's going to get the jokes.
Right, right.
The
Lonely Hearts Romance Comics Podcast, in which four guys talk about romance comics and about romances in comics with Siskoid.
We're all French-Canadians here.
Marty.
In horror comics, there's often like this little, you know, romance tinge, I guess.
Okay.
Bass.
We just turned on him.
And yours truly, Fern.
I'm very aroused.
Featuring the overproduced wonder that is Romance Comics Theater every episode.
Dan, I knew it couldn't last from the first day you eyeballed me when I reported to work. It wouldn't matter if I washed in laundry soap and came to work in a burlap sack. I'd turn you on. And you have the same effect on me.
I do?
The Lonely Hearts Romance Comics Podcast, available at lonelyheartspodcast.wordpress.com and on iTunes.
We had a comic book romance.
I should really make a promo, but...
I haven't got it for most of our shows either, so...
Yeah.
So, hey, how much editing do you do on Lonely Hearts anyway?
I think we keep to the... I mean, there's we don't rant on and on. I probably cut... I cut a lot of the dead air and my frequent stuttering, that kind of thing. Because we're all using... You know, we're using our second language, so there's more hesitation. Mm-hmm. But then it's hard to cut because people talk one over the other. I don't cut out much. So what you hear is pretty much what was said.
So you guys probably have a clock running then to help keep you all aware of how much time you've got left.
Yeah, but we're in a studio, right?
So, okay.
Yeah, so we know we're not there forever. We can't, you know. But well, whenever the conversation is played out, we know it's over. And we usually double bank, so we do two episodes, bang, bang. Yeah. And then we don't have to meet up for another 5 weeks.
Right.
To Siskoid.
Okay,
I can add it to my queue.
I'm up to the fourth episode, and they ran an ad for Rolled Spine, and I'm like, we're just the deadbeat fucking dads, man. We just, like, we donated our sperm to this podcast, and then we've not commented, we've hardly ever tweeted, we are just fucking awful, and especially with us being on hiatus all this time, it's like, these guys are filling our void, so.
Wait, what's it called? Hold on. What's
the Lonely Hearts Romance Comics Podcast.
That's a long name, but we just, it's Lonely Hearts for short. Basically, it's four guys talking about romance comics, and... We're in no way experts. In fact, quite the opposite. We're discovering them. And I always do a little production where there's a
like
romance
a
comics
play.
Theater where I get voice people voice an actual comic, usually something horrid from the 50s or 60s. And then I put a little music to it. And it's very much based on your show in that it's just, you know, people who would just chit-chat normally about stuff like this. So it's got the same feel, I think, as Rolled Spine. That's what we were going for.
It actually has given me some insight because I've listened to these shows, but I've not left any comments. And I can see why, like, especially on our Rolled Spines, why we don't get any comments. Because unless you're sitting there with a pen and paper and keeping track of all the different, you know, bouncing points of the conversation, it's like once the show's over with, it's like, I enjoyed that. I wouldn't know where to start in commenting on what I just listened to, though.
Right.
Because it's just all over the place. But it is entertaining. And it's like I listen to most of my podcasts these days in the car because I'm just doing a lot of driving to and from work. And so it's nice to have something I can just turn on. And it does feel like a nice conversation, these guys in the car. I'm still having trouble telling everybody apart. But the banter works really well, though.
There's probably one person too many. I'm now a subscriber, so I will definitely give you some feedback.
So Marty cool. Light is the guy that sounds like one of us, and then everybody else has the French accent.
No,
and,
Fern is the one that sounds like
wait,
you.
Fern, shit. Okay, so Marty is the one who has that
Fern
kind
has
of,
a similar story to mine in that he...
He's got a screwy kind of accent, right? Where you're right, because I remember I was listening to the current one where it's not quite French and it's not quite English. It's like this weird little middle place with him.
Right. We'll all come from different parts of the... No, actually, Fern comes from the same area as I do. So he's got English speakers. And he says he's a unilingual English speaker, but it's not true. He's a Francophone. But he spent some time down in Alabama. So, I mean, his English is probably the most
Texas
neutral.
Affects an Alabama accent that's just as much of a backhand as any of the ones you complained about tonight. Alabama?
Alabama?
I call shenanigans.
If I affect a Southern accent, I can totally lose. I mean, I'm sure it's not a correct Southern accent for any area, any specific area, but it would cancel out my French-Canadian accent. It's just the way it is. I try to keep them short, like no more than an hour, and hopefully it's fun. And I put a lot of bells and whistles. It's just a place for me to have fun doing sound editing. Mm-hmm. So I put a lot of little
beats. I actually like that. You've got very clear cues that, okay, I'm going to insert this here. I like your little tones and stuff to let people know where you're going or what you're doing at this particular point in time when you're inserting stuff.
Yeah, because I've also got a French language podcast, which is an interview show. It's long. It's just talking. It's improv related anyways. But that takes a lot of time to edit, and I've got to do two edits. I've got an edit for radio, and I've got an edit for podcasting. It's part of the deal why I can use a radio studio. Can't use any music because it's also going to play on so many platforms that I don't always have the rights to the music, and it might be a problem. So with Lonely Hearts, I can just go wild and find all sorts of little clips that might fit the conversation. And
uh-oh, hello, shit, guys, I'm not, hold on, if you're hearing
no,
me,
no, I'm here,
you're hearing you me here? Okay, did we lose,
hello,
there you are,
okay, you're back, okay.
Yeah, we aliens fucking abducted you for a moment there. It was just like this weird staccato humming sound.
He went kind of Max Headroom. Do you get that reference, Discord?
That's funny you should say that. Our latest episode has the episode that came out this week has a whole Max Headroom
shut
bit
up
where I'm the serious? Only I'm the only fucking one on the panel who knows what Max, no, I guess that's me, what it was. But I was like, they're all going, I was born in the 90s, okay, shut up. You know, and so I, and there's even, yeah, I put some clips of Max Headroom in there. Big Max Headroom fan, thank you. So yes, I got that, but
I didn't have cable, so I didn't watch the talk show, but I did watch the ABC sci-fi show when it was
right
there.
That one,
yeah.
I'd seen the movie the year before in a hotel room.
I had that on VHS. I had I bought the VHS from a video store back when it came out. So
well, that's the format it should live on.
Yeah,
really, but yeah. So anyways,
By the way, do you also get way too excited when Matt Frewer turns up in every fucking thing, like all this weird genre shit that he's always doing?
Yeah,
like look, it's Matt Frewer. It's like nobody gives a shit who the fuck Matt Frewer is, except for
Matt Frewer is he's the guy you call when Robin Williams won't make it.
Well, he's getting a lot of calls these days, then.
Yeah, I guess. But that was the that's why he was on Next Generation, or when he showed up on Star Trek Next Generation. It was supposed to be Robin Williams' role, and it fell through.
Wow, I'm surprised. Whoopi couldn't pull that. Couldn't hit her from Robin.
Probably just a schedule problem.
Yeah,
I don't remember the reason, but that's how Matt Frewer got in. Yeah, sure, Matt Frewer, of course.
Hey, shout out! We'll tweet him this podcast,
and also my episode of Lonely Hearts.
But my point is, I'm still trying to learn who everybody is, so I get why people had that trouble with us. But I'm enjoying the banter regardless of who's saying what. So just want to put that out there.
Appreciate
it. Yeah, but maybe I'm trying to do, they need a spotlight moment so I can figure out who the hell each person is, because I haven't quite got it yet.
Yeah, well, I'm planning something where maybe there's going to be like little pairing offs.
Okay,
so
that's cool.
Yeah. Oh, so if you know who I am, then the other guy will get a spotlight moment.
Yeah. And the one other thing too is that when the Captain America episode comes out, which should be episode 50 now, just so you know, we did not rip off the format of the romantic drama theater. Yeah. We actually, one of the, like the second or third session we ever had together, we recorded parts of a radio play for the origin of Captain America, and it's taken this entire time before it was finally ready to come out. So, but it's going to look like we're biting your bit, but really it's just that it's been in the deep freeze for a long time and you came out in the midst of that. So.
I stole your whole fucking format. So,
well, it was funny because as soon as you brought that up, I was like, oh, we've done that before. Then I was like, wait, nobody knows that we've done that before, because the episode hasn't come out yet. So maybe I'll just shut up about that. But yeah.
Well, and that part's done. The radio play is completely done. That's already in the can, because the first hour of that special is already just done. It's set. And it's just the second hour I need to go in there and edit in. But what was I going to say? Shit, I forgot.
Well, you do it with your I Don't Have to Diablo, too. I mean, you do you act out.
Yeah,
but little, no, but that's before anything, though. That was literally like one of the second or third thing we recorded was parts of that radio drama. And
I'm just saying, but it's not released to anybody, bro.
I know. Nobody knows, though, but that's, it's coming. It's coming, finally.
All right, guys.
I'm just going to cut you loose with one caveat. I'm going to need you to say your name and prostitute yourself real quick.
What do you mean? Oh, I want to, you need me to sell my shit? Is that it?
But I also need you to say your name, because I want to do your little ID badge. Once you're part of the Agents of Marvel workforce, you've got to have your little ID badge.
Okay. And is my name Siskoid?
Yes.
Okay. Well, my name is Siskoid. You want me to do it like that?
Say it in a way that you won't get sick of hearing your own voice.
This is Siskoid. Like that. I'll do it like that. This is Siskoid from the blog. No, that's not even the name of it. Fuck. it's 1:15. This is Siskoid from Siskoid's blog of geekery, and also from the Lonely Hearts Romance Comics podcast, and also from... No, that's enough. I mean, just go to one of those and it'll lead you to the rest.
Fair few Secret Origins guest appearances. And
there is, and Hero Points, DC Comics role-playing.
I don't think there's been two episodes. You got to give up the ghost on that shit.
Shag's got to give up the ghost. But I'm sure we'll do more. That's enough, right?
Yearly. It's the Hero Points annual.
Yeah, we could do that. But really, those are my two credits. Do you need more?
Say your name one more time, just to be on the safe side.
My name is still Siskoid.
Since Mac finally set up the Facebook page, we received likes from CJ Gonzalez, Joseph Crawford, Keechy Baker, Matt Ev, Shag Matthews, and Siskoid, as well as new Twitter follows from Adventure Seeker, Ahmed Mar, All About Indie Games, App Tasket, Board Game Republic, Body Count Rising, Brian Brushwood, Bull and Ball Comic, Captain Marvel at Captain Marvel 75, The Cinematologists, Gloria Pfefferl, Luest, Paul Joshua T. Ariza, Selfie-matic, Sequel Prequel Equal Podcast, Successful Crowdfund, Susan Bennett, Warlord Worlds Podcast, WickedHorror.com, and Yasmin Pakamara. Twitter favorites came from The 108th Sage, Anthony Miyazaki, Behind the Magic Podcast, Count Druncula, Jason Martinez, Legiticus, Odell Abner Dracula, Over Newser Movies, The Park Fanatic Podcast, Party Roll Podcast, Rob Deb, Taman Bob, Timos Stofrigin, and Valentinos Orfanos. Jason Martinez let us know that he's listening to the Marvel Superheroes podcast. Doctor Strange, Master of Black Magic, another good episode. Siskoid wrote of episode 46, Wild Agents of Marvel, Token Fire Guy. That Marvel Resident Evil you're talking about has to be about Elsa Bloodstone, of course. For Captain Marvel, I still like the perhaps obvious casting of Battlestar Galactica's Katie Sackhoff. Obvious in the sense that she's played a badass pilot who used to be played by a guy too. Definitely someone that can pull off the Ripley-Sarah Connor thing, in my opinion. Siskoid also wrote of episode 48, Doctor Strange, Master of Black Magic. The radio show elements were great, especially the way Mordo pronounces Dormammu. As for Mac thinking Lonely Hearts is any better than Rolled Spine, the grass is always greener, my friend. Let's not go crazy. And now the Mary Marvel Marching Society, featuring Adam Blackmoon, Ashley Rose, Bone Dragon Comics, Charlton Hero, CJ, Coffee and Comics Blog, Comics Reflections, Darren and Ruth Sutherland, Dr. G Nerdologist, Drunken Dork Podcast, Future Primitive, The Illegal Formation Podcast, Joseph Crawford, Kevin Dodgy, Keith G. Baker, Mark Sweeney, Marvel Incorporated 2099, Out of the Fridge Podcast, Pittsburgh Nerd Podcast, The Penultimate, Randy Caldwell, Siskoid, Sin at Alias Scarecrow, Too Dangerous for a Girl Blog, and Trekker Talk Podcast.
The Marvel Superheroes podcast is in no way affiliated with or endorsed by Marvel Entertainment. All characters mentioned and audio clips employed are believed covered under fair use, with no infringement intended against their copyright holders. The views expressed in this podcast are assumed legitimate, truthful, and solely possessed by the speaker.
This is Siskoid.